I believe you need to know who your donors are. One, so that you can steward them properly and thank them properly, and start to build that relationship with them. And then a lot of times with major gift fundraising, what happens is donors will give what they call a starter gift. So they'll give a smaller, larger gift to kind of see, okay, how will this organization use my money? Will they use it like they say they're going to use it? Will I be properly thanked, like, you know, properly stewarded? And then they'll give a bigger gift, or then they'll leave you in their will. And so there is no shame in that. No, like I've never even thought about not wanting to. It makes sense now that you explain it that way, and I get the thinking of that. But being in fundraising for so long, I just know how donors, especially, you know, higher level donors, expect to be treated. And if they don't want to be treated that way, they'll be anonymous.
Welcome to Mindful Leader, a podcast about leadership at the local church. This target audience for Mindful Leader is both laity and clergy. My name is Dennis Shaw. I'm a retired elder in the Mountain Sky Conference of the United Methodist Church. Today, my guest is Angela Willingham. She is the Vice President for Development at Wesley Theological Seminary in the District of Columbia. And we will, in the conversation, get to a little bit of her resume and talk a little bit about the education and experience that she had in order to be the Vice President for Development. Development officers are fundraisers. That's what they do. There are conversations that we are going to have on Mindful Leader that are seasonal. The last two conversations we had were about General Conference in late April, early May in Charlotte, North Carolina. But I want most of the conversations to be sort of what you might think of as evergreen conversations. They are always green. They're always relevant. And today's is a return to that evergreen theme, is that I'd like to believe that what Angela and I talk about is useful to you in March, and it might be useful to you in October, November, or December. It's useful year-round. I am mindful that a lot of people don't like to talk about money. Believe me, I was there at one time, and there are elements of my growth when I stopped being in ministry, active ministry, at the local church that I still think I could have improved on. And we try to steer the conversation a little bit towards that. This is Mindful Leader.
I got the idea from this conversation, from a conversation I had with the president of Wesley Theological Seminary about 20 years ago. That's David McAllister Wilson. And I had a conversation with him as I was entering into ministry. That's be about 25 years ago. And I confessed to David that I struggled with talking about money from the pulpit, talking about money in the local church. And in love and kindness, without guilt, David said, "Dennis, you need to work on that. You need to work on that." And so I did. And I got to a place where that weakness in 1999, by the time I retired from ministry in 2019, had become somewhat of a strength. That said, there were still areas for me to do better in. Angela's going to talk a little bit about some of those things where I think I could do better, and I wonder if it might not be an area where the potential listener, be they lay or clergy, could do a little bit better as well. Welcome, Angela. Thank you very much for having said yes to being on Mindful Leader.
Of course. Thank you, and my pleasure.
Angela, you have a title related to development, and you are a vice president there at Wesley. What's the experience and education that you had in order to get qualified to have this role there at Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C.?
Sure. So I'll take you back a long time ago. I attended undergrad at University of Central Oklahoma. I was a Presidential Leadership Council member there, and it was a scholarship for the top incoming students in leadership. And I was first generation college graduate. And I was at a luncheon getting to meet some of the donors who made my scholarship possible. I think it was like my sophomore year. And I had been really floundering in what to major in. I thought, oh, what am I going to major in? And I've tried all sorts of things. And really what it came down to is I really enjoyed people and storytelling and marketing. And I got to know these donors, and my mentor came up to me after the lunch and she said, "You realize what you just did was as a job. You realize it's a career. It's called fundraising." And I said, "No, I have no idea." So she coached me through it, and I majored in public relations. So it really started, you know, that was back in 1996. So it was quite a long time ago. And that's how, you know, I got interested in fundraising. So my undergrad is in communications public relations. I then worked for a while. My first big fundraising job was on the Las Vegas Strip. I did events in Las Vegas. And my first big job was a concert with Wayne Newton, which was shocking because it was 99 and I didn't know Wayne Newton was still alive, but God bless him, he was still alive and singing strong. And from there, you know, it was a temp job, and I just fell in love with events. And then from there, got hired to work at a private school to do their events. And then the person who hired me there, his name's Jay Howard, has really served as kind of a lifelong mentor to me and taught me all about fundraising and not just events. I think a lot of people think about fundraising. They think, oh, let's host a special event and we'll you know, make all this money in one night. And events are good for stewardship and for cultivation. And it is good fundraising, but really what I'm passionate about is major gift fundraising. So from there, I was really in, he hired me to work at a private school in Las Vegas. And from there, my husband and I have taken turns following our careers from Las Vegas to Dallas and now to DC. And so I spent 18 years in the private school sector, and out in DC, I was at Holden Arms School for a long time. It's a school, third grade through 12th for girls. And then from there, I thought I want a little bit of a change in education. And so went to a community foundation about a year and a half before COVID hit. And we did crisis response. And so a lot of time doing crisis response for COVID. And then this position, another mentor of mine contacted me and told me about the position at Wesley and said, this is your job. You got to come interview for this job. And that's been over 2.5 years ago now. I actually started 2 years ago this month at Wesley. And so lots of experience with major gifts, lots of experience with campaigns, mostly in the education field.
And that's where you and I actually met, was at some kind of donor-related event where I think it was intended to share with us a little bit of where our donations had gone, what had happened, the change that had occurred as a result of that.
Yeah, it's one of the most important things you can do as a fundraiser is to demonstrate impact. And so we wanted to celebrate with you all. It was the Lewis Leadership, is the Lewis Center for Church Leadership's 20th anniversary. Yeah. Oh, and I forgot to add in there, I did in the middle of that get my master's in strategic communications and leadership from Seton Hall University. So
Seton Hall's in New York. Do I have that right?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yeah.
I know it's got a good basketball team. You're in and you're out.
Yes. Great communications department. It was a hybrid program, you know, 12 years ago. So it was pretty cool to get to do it that long ago.
Yeah. And you're a lay person. You're not clergy. I think anybody could tell that by your biography you went through there. Mm-hmm. And when you and I chatted about this, you talked about the fact that you have gotten to a place where you have a significant amount of passion associated with this, linking up major donors and their participation in the funding of various things. Here is the case of the funding of seminary education. My guess is that you have some first principles that you operate from. Would you like to share those with people that are listening to us?
Sure. So absolutely. The first thing is that, you know, when people think, in my family, you know, I come from a smaller town in Oklahoma, and whenever people talk to me about what I do for a living, and they're like, oh, I could never ask for money. And I think that's a common either fear or just hesitation of like, oh, I could never ask for money. And what I always say is that money changes the world. You can make a big difference with money. And number two, I'm not asking for myself. I'm not asking for them to buy me a house or a car or a purse or anything. I see myself more as a matchmaker. And I'm talking to people who really want to make a difference. I'm not having to twist anyone's arms and say, okay, I know you want to make a difference. I know you want to contribute. here are the things that we have going on at whatever organization I'm working at. So at Wesley, we have so many amazing programs. So let's take we have a military chaplain program. So let's take that program for instance. So if I'm talking to someone who's really passionate about the spiritual health of our soldiers and all of our military personnel, and I find that connection, I go, oh my gosh, let me tell you about the military chaplain program. So that's my first principle, is that it's okay to talk about money. It's okay to ask for money. But in order to do it in a graceful and sophisticated way, it's an ongoing relationship. I really see it like, hope this is okay for your audience, but I see it more like dating, where you're really getting to know someone. And by the time you pop the question, you know if they're going to say yes or not, right? So, so a lot of that time is spent in what fundraisers call the cultivation stage. So really getting to know the donor, building the relationship between the donor and the organization, and then just asking them, you know, like, how would you like to make an impact? And if you want to ask for a specific dollar amount, you can. So that's the number one principle. Number two is to be donor-centered and data-driven. So the term donor-centered came up probably, oh gosh, I'm going to say over 20 years ago now. I've been in the industry 25 years. And it was early on in my career by a researcher and teacher named Penelope Berg. And she's written several books on donor-centered fundraising. And she did all of this research. And what she found is that donors who give at a certain level really see themselves as investors in your organization and in your cause. And so you need to demonstrate impact, like I was sharing earlier. You need to appreciate the gift. And then you need to keep them, you know, you need to keep them close to your organization by sharing what's going on, cultivating them, inviting them to different events, and then, you know, stewarding the gift. And so that's the key part of it, is the relationship. I'm all about the relationship in major gift fundraising. But if I'm all about the relationship in major gift fundraising, the piece that's going to drive that is, if you're donor-centered, you need to be data-driven. So I have worked with some lovely, lovely fundraisers who are all about the relationship, but never get to the ask, because they just don't, one, have the courage, or they don't have the system in place to get them to that. And so there actually is a system in major gift fundraising called Moves Management. And you can just Google fundraising Moves Management, and you'll find all sorts of different things, because it's tailored specifically mostly for each office is a little bit different. But in our office, we have a 5-stage approach. And I can talk to you more about that later if you want to talk more about that. But I am donor-centered and data-driven. And we're only as good as our systems. So whenever I come into a new shop, I always look at, okay, I want to start building relationships right away, and I want to start looking at our systems.
You talk about keeping people close, and I know that one of the concerns clergy have is giving significant donors too much weight at the local church level. Now, I realize your expertise is not at the local church. It's more institution. It's different institution than that. But my guess is you've heard that before, and my guess is you've thought about that. What would you say to clergy who might be concerned about that?
Well, we experienced that as an administration. I think at every private school I've ever worked at, which would be 3. You know, so donors. The flip side of being donor-centered is that there are some donors who see it more as a quid pro quo. I'll give you this and you'll do what I want. And you just have to be upfront during the process of, you know, we appreciate your support. We're so grateful for your support. And then if they start to say, well, if you could do this in return, you can say, well, we can't accept the gift with those kind of restrictions. So I work a lot in what's called either restricted giving or unrestricted giving. So if it's an unrestricted gift, meaning it just goes to support our operating, and if they start suggesting what we need to do with that money, I would have a conversation with them and say, well, that wasn't part of the agreement. And if that's what you want to do with the money and that doesn't align with our either strategic vision or our mission or our plan, then we'll probably need to get to refund your money or give your money back. We used to always joke at Holton that if someone came in and said, hey, we'll give you $50 million if you let boys in, we would turn them down because it would not be aligned with our mission.
Okay. We think back to the movie Chocolat. Part of the subtext of the story is that the most wealthy man in town buys the buys the pastor, he buys the parish priest.
Wow.
And so he sort of writes his sermons for him. And at some point, the pastor sets himself free. He's willing to say, I have to speak. The word is what I'm called to. And even though you support this church significantly with your donations, I can't let you run this church with your values. And to me, that's the way you phrase that is that you have to make sure in the process that that they're not buying you as a voice to put their views forward. I wish this wasn't true in our country right now, but there's times where inside of a church, it represents the nation at large. We are politically divided in this country. Mm-hmm. And there are times where people want to control the pastor with their political view. They want their political view to come from the pulpit. And that gets to be a bit of a challenge at times.
Well, and that goes back to the systems as well, because, you know, one of the things I've instituted at Wesley is having very clear gift agreements. So a gift agreement, it can be very simple. Some people just use an email. I like to formalize it and actually have it on letterhead and have both parties sign it. But you say, especially if it's a larger gift, right? If it's a weekly tithing, like that's going to be a different situation. But if it's a large gift, say someone comes in and says, I want to create a scholarship for, you know, I'm going to give you $100,000 to start a scholarship. That's fantastic. And then we start having a conversation and I said, well, tell me, like, do you want this to go to master's or doctoral students? Do you want this to go to people who only live in, you know, like Maryland or which conference? You know, I'm learning all about the Methodist conferences. And
right.
And so if they keep restricting, I'll talk to them about, well, you know, you're restricting this to a point that it's really not going to be advantageous for either one of us because we might not be able to spend the money and support the students because it's all about the students.
Yeah.
So if you have a gift agreement in place, so, you know, fundraisers, the average tenure of a fundraiser is 18 months. And so you've got to create these systems and these documents. So when the next person comes in, that donor doesn't say, oh, you know what, I gave that money and it's actually supposed to only go to Southern Baptist students from Texas. And you can go back and look and say, but the gift agreement you signed said it could go to anyone pursuing a Master's of Divinity.
Yeah.
And then, oh, you're right. So you just have to have these things in place. And as much as we trust people, it's just better to get it in writing.
My donation, for example, to Wesley is earmarked to the Lewis Center for Leadership. And I also do it to support students. There's a fund that is there for students to go abroad as part of groups. And so that's where my money goes. And partly because I just believe it's good for students to see the rest of the world. But it's also because I believe firmly in what it is that the Lewis Center for Leadership is doing.
Yeah, and that goes back to another point that Penelope Burke made in her research is that people like to give to specific programs.
Yeah.
So that's why you have to get to know your donors to know like what they want to support. And there are some donors out there that say, you know what, I really like to support overhead. We go, great. You know, so they give unrestricted, but the if they give to a specific program, that's great information to have because then you know how to show them how their gift was used.
One of the debate, in at least the clergy world, and I think to some extent it's true in the laity world, is about the nature of the names, of who knows the names and who knows what's giving, who's giving what and how much. I confess that 25 years ago, I operated from a thesis that I didn't need to know. I did not need to know that. And gradually over time, I got to a place by the time I left ministry in 2019, although this podcast is a ministry, and I'm doing this as a ministry, but I left at least the local church. I'd gotten to a place where I felt like I needed to know. I really felt like I needed to know. And I understand that you're in a different role with the organizationally, but what might you say to those who say, I don't need to know and I don't want to know? What might you say to them as encouragement towards a particular direction?
So imagine someone leaves you a package on your front steps and it's filled with money and it's exactly the amount you needed for the project that you wanted to do it. And you were so over the moon grateful and you just want to know like who left this so that I can thank them. I really want to thank them so that they know what a difference they made. So if they leave, if they don't put their name on it, they don't want to be known. They don't want that special treatment. If they put their name on it, they want you to thank them. They want the special treatment. And when I say special treatment, I mean, wouldn't you treat anyone special who did something really nice for you? I mean, they're doing something really nice for you. And so I believe you need to know who your donors are. One, so that you can steward them properly and thank them properly, and start to build that relationship with them. And then a lot of times with major gift fundraising, what happens is donors will give what they call a starter gift. So they'll give a smaller, larger gift to kind of see, okay, how will this organization use my money? Will they use it like they say they're going to use it? Will I be properly thanked? Will I be, you know, properly stewarded? And then they'll give a bigger gift, or then they'll leave you in their will. And so there is no shame in that. No, like I've never even thought about not wanting to. I make sense now that you explain it that way, and I get the thinking of that. But being in fundraising for so long, I just know how donors, especially, you know, higher level donors, expect to be treated. And if they don't want to be treated that way, they'll be anonymous, or they'll come out and tell you, this is a one-time gift. Please, you know, don't put me on some sort of list now. You know, it was given in memory of someone. We've had that before where someone gives a large gift in memory and we reach out and they say, thank you, but please don't add me to your mailing list or your call list or anything. This was a one-time thing. And that's very helpful too, because you know then how to move forward. But I would say you really do need to know who your donors are.
I don't think it's any secret. I'm 76 years old, and my wife is, both of us are past 70 and a half. And we give away our IRA. We give it away. It's mm-hmm. never income to us. We give a lot of it to church-related stuff, but we give it away also to, like, Wounded Warrior. We give it to Habitat for Humanity. We give it to Compassion International. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I mean, some of them, for example, will say, thank you very much for your $1,000 gift. Here's things that we're doing. If you get another $1,000, we'd like to for you to know that these are kind of where our investment would be. If you mm-hmm. were, so right away, I mean, right away, they're not afraid to come back with a borderline second ask, even though I've just sent them $1,000 or $1,500, they're not afraid to come back with a second ask. And a lot of it is related to what you were saying is, and this is what we would do with it if you were able to find that capacity.
Now that's fascinating. So in my office, we don't do that because, and it's called, that's, it's called a THASK, THASK. That's a thank you ask. And I'm a big believer in just thanking the donor and giving them some space and demonstrating the impact that gift has. You mm-hmm. have to, if you want to go back to first principles, one of the very first principles, I can't believe I forgot to mention this, is you have to earn the right to ask.
Yeah.
You can't just walk up to someone and you wouldn't just walk up to someone and ask them to marry you, right?
Got
So you have to earn that right to ask, and then you have to earn that right to ask again. You know, you can't just sit around, that's great, can you give me more? But that might be their philosophy and that might work for them. It's just, I might be a little old school in that way.
I've been giving, I think, to Wesley for over 20 years. And every year I get a thank you note from you or David McAllister Wilson or from Doug Poe mm-hmm. Over at, somebody sends me a note saying thank you very much for this. So it's a powerful element of that. Is there wisdom that you, I think we've focused on wisdom and we've called it first principles, but I interpret these first principles as bits of wisdom. Advice that you share. Where has your in this area? Where has your personal growth been? So where were you approximately? Let's say 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and where have you changed? What has been the transformation process in you in this? Is that a fair question?
Sure. I think, you know, 20 years ago. I was probably at SMU. So I was at Southern Methodist University for a little while.
My wife's an SMU graduate, by the
way. Oh, really? Oh, good place.
Right.
I love my time at SMU. It's a great school. But you know, for the most part, I really had not learned. I was probably just starting to come out of the events stage of my life, meaning, you know, of my career, meaning that, okay, I'm planning events. We make, you know, event planning and fundraising through events. I always love when I hear someone say, oh my gosh, they raised 1.5 million in one night. Well, that took about 18 months of planning and cultivating, and you know, it's not one night. So, but you know, shifting from being an events-based fundraiser to more of a relationship fundraiser is where I was about 20 years ago. I also had a little bit of a break in my career. I saw the writing on the wall of how much communications and storytelling was going to go into fundraising. So that's when I shifted and went back and got my master's from Seton Hall. So with donors, you go from transactional. So that's the kind of, you know, NPR model, you know, give this and you'll get a tote bag or, you know, that kind of thing. Or maybe one of your friends asked you to support their cause. So you have this transactional giving that then you go into, and that's given kind of the quid pro quo and add people giving out of obligation because they feel like they should give. And then you get into transitional giving, which is really when people start to give out of just a deep gratitude for either what that organization did for them or does for others. And so that's called transitional giving. And then you get to transformational giving. And that's when really they start to develop that deep relationship with the organization, not only like volunteer-wise or time-wise if they're doing that, but really financially. And so, but what I've seen time and time again is that some fundraisers will not consider a donor who gives a $5,000 gift a transformational donor. Now, if that donor saved that up for several years, it's a transformational gift because it transforms the relationship between that donor and the organization. And that's what I mean when I talk about transformational. I know that's not what everyone means. I know that's not what the textbooks mean. They're meaning like the $10 million gift, but those are very rare. And so, you know, I have worked with donors who give $100,000 like it's not like it's like no big deal because it's the percentage of their wealth, it's nothing. But then I have other donors who give $5,000 or $10,000, and it's a large percentage of their annual pay or their annual income. And they really want to be part of the organization, and they are some of your best ambassadors. So that's some of the wisdom I've found too, is to not don't sweat that, like the people who give the smaller donations, you know, make sure they're thanked and give them the letters and stuff. But look at those mid-range people and really focus on building that relationship with them and getting them to be long-term. And of course, never ever ignore your top people. I'm not saying that, but I just feel like a lot of people go only for like the top five donors or the top 10 donors. That would be appropriate for the president. So David McAllister Wilson really focuses on, like, because he has a lot of things to do. So, you know, in his portfolio, because we all carry portfolios, he has donors who give at a very high level to make sure that we build those relationships with him. But David has been around for so long. Everybody knows David and loves David. So that's what's so great, right? I mean, he's been there 42 years. I mean, I've never worked at another place that's had that kind of longevity in a leader.
Let's talk for a second about portfolios. You went to that, and my experience in Salt Lake at Hilltop is that part of how I was able to let my stewardship team try to help me on that was I let them do a lot of the one-on-one. They did the one-on-one dialogue, so that became their in my way of thinking about what you said with portfolio. That became part of their portfolio. Is that sort of what you meant by that term?
Yeah, so I can actually. So one, the process by which that I was talking about earlier, the MOVES management. So major gift officers, they're also called fundraisers or frontline fundraisers. Anyone in the organization that's doing the asking. I believe everyone in the organization is a fundraiser,
Yep,
in the sense
yep.
of creating that culture of philanthropy, treating everyone with, you know, having delighting them, surprising them, all those things. But if you know, your core group of people who make the asks carry a portfolio. And so what will happen is you might not, so let's, you know, say you as the head of the organization or the lead pastor, you probably wouldn't have that many people in your portfolio because really what happens is the person, the fundraiser, that manages the relationship, that's what they're doing. They're managing them through the MOVES management process. The donor cycle is what it's called. And so the donor cycle, which is MOVES management, donor cycle at Wesley is 5 steps. So we have the identification stage, the qualification stage, the cultivation stage, the solicitation stage, and then the stewardship phase. And so that's the donor giving cycle. And the person who is the fundraiser for that prospect or for that donor manages that process. So yeah, so the people who handle that for you, if they're doing the stewarding or they're doing the cultivating, that's exactly what they should be doing. And earlier we talked about this too, about like asking, maybe the pastor's not comfortable asking for money. If it doesn't seem authentic, or if it seems like it would put, like if you have a really close relationship or friendship with someone and you're like, I'm not comfortable asking them for money, that's okay. That head person, that president or pastor can be, you know, brought in as part of the cultivation. And then the other person, the fundraiser, or usually like if it's a smaller group, maybe you have a volunteer or you have someone on your board, make the ask. Uh-huh. And so, but they still need to play a role in that MOVES management process by either being part of the cultivation. But the people who are in, so say my portfolio, I have around 160 people in my portfolio. So that's a little large for my position, but we're working on that. But my job then is to make sure that I know all the people in that portfolio, that I know their interests. I know
their story.
Know their story. Is there anything I can do to support them? And then if they want to meet with David, or if I think they need to meet with David, then I go to David and say, hey, can you meet with this donor? They don't have to be in his portfolio in order for him to have a relationship with them. It just means I'm the one that's managing the process.
Yeah,
once you get back to systems. Yeah.
And what I hear you saying is that, I mean, a lot of people that are pastors are highly relational.
Yes.
So the element, every one of them, no matter where they are in that MOVE process you were talking about, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes so people can sort of see that. But no matter where they are in the process, they can certainly be part of the relationship issue between the local church and that individual.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And that's, so there's this phrase, because especially in higher education fundraising, people get a little territorial over their donors because we are measured on how much money we bring in. And so there's this phrase called prospect hoarding. And so I do not advocate for prospect hoarding, but you'll hear that's an issue at some places. So no, the more, the merrier. I mean, you let the donor kind of guide that, like who do they want to get to know, you know, when you find out their interests.
Another area, and again, this was something I noticed in Utah, was about the second or third year I was there. It was about 2014, 2015 or so. We needed $100,000 in sound system. We need our sound system, both speakers, everything about it was too old. It was just not fulfilling our need. And so what we did, and it wasn't necessarily my idea, but we put together a coalition. We got the trustees to give us $30,000 from some of their money that they had from the endowment kind of thing. Then we went to some key givers and got around $30,000. So when we announced the program, we only needed $33,000 as opposed to $100,000, because $67,000 had been dealt with by major donors that we had gone to before, and by the trustees going to the endowment. So we went from a $100,000 requirement to a $30,000 requirement, $33,000. And it was interesting because we solved the problem like in 2 weeks. I mean, we went from it being a problem of just tremendous magnitude to all of a sudden it was $15,000 or $22,000 checks, and just bang, it went away.
Well, you did that perfectly, Dennis. I don't know if someone was helping you. So you did a mini campaign, and so what you do in campaigns is you build your case for support. So you probably had a list like, here's what we need, here's why we need it. Yeah. You went to the board. So you got that. And so that's what's called a quiet phase. So during a quiet phase, you know, you went to the board and you went to some key donors, so that when you announced it during the public phase, your donors weren't overwhelmed, because Like you hear, oh my gosh, we have zero, but we need to get to 100,000. And you're looking at us, the people who can give maybe like maximum $1,000, you're going to need that. You know, so they start doing the math in their head. But if you go, you know, if you do it properly and you do a quiet phase and you get those people early on, especially if they'll lend their name to the cause, and then you can use their names to then go and say, well, one, when you're talking to them, you say, you ask them the key question always, who else should I be talking to? And then they'll go, oh, you know what? I know Joe. He's really into, did you know his father-in-law owns this sound company? Talk to him about getting a discount, and then talk to Susie about, you know, so you start to find, you start to build these relationships with the people that you talk to early on. And then the flip side of it is if you go out early, if you go out just public right away and say, we need $100,000, you're bored and your top donors are going to say, well, why didn't you come to us? And you're going to lose that opportunity of making them feel really special. Because I know some people might think of it as the people don't like to be asked for money, but they do. There are a lot of people who want to help and want you to come to them first so that they can say, yeah, let me help you. Just tell me what you need. I guarantee you there's at least a couple of those in every church.
Well, I know there's some people who don't like Dave Ramsey out of Nashville, and I understand there can be some controversy about that. But one of the things he focuses on is by getting yourself to a position of financial stability in your own household, it gives you the latitude to put your resources against things that you really have passions about. And that's been true in our household. And so people are not afraid to come ask us because they know we own our own house, for example. We've paid for our, so where we are in our life is that people are willing to come say, gosh, I'd like to, could I interest you in supporting a ministry that changes lives? And we go from there.
And don't you are in on the flip side, aren't you in this where you want to help?
I do. Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't get there, but that's exactly it. We want to be part of this transformation.
Yeah. And it's hard. And that's what's hard sometimes with fundraisers starting out earlier in their career, especially if they, you know, I didn't come from wealth. I come from a very humble family in Southwest Oklahoma. So the idea that I could go ask someone for $100,000 in 2001 and they could write me a check for it blew my mind.
Yeah.
So once you get over that, you have to get over your own issues with money. And that's something that you can do. So I think Dave Ramsey can help with that. I think therapy can help, whatever you need to get over your own issues with money and know that money is just, it's just energy exchanging hands.
Well, how did we begin? I mean, it was with David McAllister Wilson, gently, lovingly, kindly telling me I needed to get over my aversion to not talking about money.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So anything you want to clarify or anything I didn't ask that I should have?
You know, I think because I have talked to several graduates who have reached out and taken me to coffee and said, you know, will you explain this to me? And so I think, you know, it's something to explore is this idea of, you know, and I know the Lewis Center teaches some classes. Ann Michael is a fantastic teacher and they teach some classes on fundraising. But I do wonder, like, as people are studying in seminary to become pastors, and I know there's the financial side of it, personal financial side, I do wonder, I like to wonder, you know, if there should be some sort of fundraising training in as part of seminary. And maybe, you know, podcasts like this or other things can help people who are currently in that training or are currently, in the training and currently doing the job. But I think the more people that you can talk to like me or bring this awareness to pastors to know that it's okay to ask for money and it's okay to be, you know, to know where the money is coming from could be really helpful in growing the church.
One of my mentors has retired and gone to Wisconsin, but it was Kent Ingram, and he was at Colorado Springs First. Mm. And it was essentially his view, it would be difficult to pastor a congregation like Colorado Springs First, which had 1,000 in attendance, $3 million budget. It would be difficult to pastor a church of that size if you were uncomfortable talking about money. You had to get to a place where you, in some kind of way, in some kind of way, you had to get past your discomfort. And there's multiple ways to get past that, but you had to be able to get to a place where you were prepared to talk about that. That was sort of his thesis. And to me, a lot of the more effective larger church pastors, they've somewhere along the line figured that out, and they're able to do that.
I have heard from some people that they've heard advice about only focus on the major donors, only focus on the people who can give large donations. And that would be amazing if you had that kind of psychic ability, because but it just doesn't exist. So you'll spend, I just want people to be aware, they're going to spend a lot of time with people who can't, who you find out, you know, you come time to ask and they go, oh, I'm sorry, I can't give at that level. Or I'm sorry, I gave that misunderstanding that I could give at that level. But it was not a waste of time because you got to know them. You never know if they might want to, you know, leave you in their will and name you in your will. But yeah, that's one of the things I've come across a couple of times in the past couple of years, people talking about, well, looking back, I wish I would have only focused on these three or four families. Well, you know that in hindsight. So for now, going forward, don't beat yourself up. It's okay to like spend time with who you think you need to spend time with.
Sometimes, Angela, I tell people that this is the beginning of a wonderful conversation, and I tell them I'm going to invite them back. I didn't warn you in advance, but I'm going to invite you back. We're going to have a, maybe in 2025, have to have a follow on to this conversation, and we'll do some more on it.
Yeah, I would love that. And I love, you know, I'm so intrigued. I want to learn more about the mindful leader. I'm a big believer in mindfulness. I'm a big believer in abundance mindset instead of deficit mindset, and how being a mindful fundraiser. Maybe that could be something we talk about in the future.
Maybe. My approach here is to some extent about self-awareness. My thesis is that it's challenging to be a leader in the 21st century without some measure of self-awareness. And I had people back earlier in my ministry who helped me move me from a place of weakness to a place of strength. My conversation with David McAllister Wilson. But nonetheless, there were people who saw things inside of me that I didn't see inside of myself and helped me draw that out. And so my thesis is that here's some things to think about. And my military background, frankly, operates from the idea that everybody can be turned into a leader. Everybody has the capacity to be a leader. There are people that are born leaders, but there are other leaders that they were cultivated into that gift of leadership. So mm-hmm. I'm in the second camp. I was cultivated, right. And I by people like David McAllister Wilson, and they cultivated me with great intentionality. And I'd like to believe I was fruitful while I was, and I'm still trying to be fruitful.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for sharing that with me. And thanks for letting me part of your show today.
Let me just say thank you again for being a guest, and God bless you. I look forward to talking to you another day.
That sounds great. Take care.
God bless.